Okay, I'd like to introduce our speaker. Before I do that, for those who don't know me, my name's Adele Pittendrick, and I'm Associate Dean in the College of Letters and Science at MSU, and work with the INBRI program. That's one of the sponsors of this event. So I'd like to welcome you all. I know some of you have been to the Café Scientifique before, and for others, this might be your first time, so I'll say a few words about this tradition. There are cafes scientifiques around the world. It's an international movement, lots of them in England especially, and it's spreading, it's spreading across the globe? Would that be an exaggeration? And the format is that we'll have our guest speaker will speak for 20 or 30 minutes. There's no PowerPoint here. It's a relaxing atmosphere, and then after he's finished, then we'll take a short break. You can help yourself to more food or replenish your drinks as you wish, and then we'll have questions and discussion. So I have a list of things I'm to tell you, and I'm going to go through them right now. First of all, I want to say that this event is sponsored by the College of Letters and Science at MSU, and the INRI program, which stands for Idea Networks of Biomedical Research Excellence and is funded by the National Institutes of Health. I'm to ask you to sign up for email updates on future cafes. So if you want to be on our email list and be notified when we have events, please be sure to sign. And Lori Howell over there is holding up the sign-up sheet. Food and drinks, appetizers are provided by the INRI program, and drinks are available for you to purchase either at the bar or from a wait person. You're welcome to stay for dinner after the cafe, and that would be at your own expense. We have two future cafes that will be coming up soon on March 12th. Dr. Louise Bennett is going to speak on practicing refugee medicine, pills versus community action. We're very excited to have her, and we will be holding our first cafe ever in Livingston at the Northern Pacific Beanery, and it'll be at 6:30 p.m. And then on March 25th, Dr. Joe Brain is going to speak on obesity, diabetes, and the rise and fall of inhaled insulin. Why did Pfeiffer pull the plug on Exubera? And that'll be here at Ferraro's Fine Dining. So now I'll introduce our speaker, Dr. Keith Norris. He's actually from New York City, grew up in Jamaica, my hometown too. He attended Cornell University and received his medical degree from Howard University. He's board certified by the American Boards of Internal Medicine and Nephrology, and as a specialist in clinical hypertension by the American Society of Hypertension. He's an active researcher in the field of kidney disease and hypertension with a focus on health disparities among disadvantaged populations. Okay, there's more. There's actually lots more. Lori sent me bullets, and I had to cut out about half of them. There were so many. He's had a long-term community involvement focusing on kidney disease education and wellness programs, especially within African American and Latino communities. He's the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Ethnicity and Disease and was named one of America's top physicians in nephrology and hypertension by the Consumers Research Council of America. He is currently professor of medicine and executive vice president for research and health affairs at Charles Drew University of Medicine and Science in Los Angeles. And he has a dual appointment with the university, with UCLA. His talk tonight is called Gut Health, Unleashing the Potential of Community Academic Partnerships. Let's welcome Dr. Keith Norris.
Thank you, Adele. Well, good evening, everybody, and thank you for having me here in Montana. It's my second time here, and it's getting better every time, so it's been great. Before I get started, I'll first ask a couple questions of the audience, then I'll say a little more about myself, and then sort of talk a little bit about some of my thoughts on how we as a society might think differently about approaching health, and hopefully do a better job of achieving the health outcomes that I think we all want to achieve. So first, how many people here are students? College. Okay. How many people here are members of community-based organizations? How many people here are faculty at the college? And how many people here are other? Okay. Excellent. I first got involved in, so as you heard, I'm a kidney specialist by training, and I was involved in doing some basic science research, and then I was doing clinical trials. And then I started becoming more involved in community partnerships. And as I started becoming more and more involved in different aspects of health, healthcare, and research, it became clear to me that there were certain things that health research did or does here in the United States that is incredible. And there are other things we do that are pitiful. And so we want to recognize both of those and figure out how we can go forward to make the incredible more incredible and make the pitiful incredible. Right now, we are probably the best place to live if you have a really serious advanced medical condition and you need intervention for cancer, for heart disease, for kidney disease. This is where you want to be in the United States, if you have insurance. If you don't have insurance, I'm not sure. I don't think this is where you want to be. But if you have insurance, this is the place to be. What we do, what our healthcare system does, it delivers the best care to individuals who are insured or have money. However, if we look at it slightly differently, if you look at preventable deaths below the age of, for people below the age of 75, can you prevent premature mortality from diabetes, from heart disease, from cancer? Among a consortium of 19 developed countries in the world, we have moved from being number 16 out of 19 in 1992 to now being number 19 out of 19. And that is despite the fact that we spend twice as much as the second most expensive country spends on healthcare. So one of the questions is, what is it that we could do differently that might allow the health arena to really move forward and deliver care in a different way and maybe with a different focus? And so now I'll sort of give my bias based on some of my experiences and based on my collaborations with some of my community partners. So first, as an academic researcher, one of the strengths that academic researchers have is we go through a lot of training to understand how to think about problems and how to address health problems. But we sit in a university or in a college, and we get information and we read journal articles and we get results of surveys, and then we make decisions about what to do in different communities. And in that process, what is missed is, from my mind, is the wealth of experience and understanding about what's happening in a particular community that many individuals in those communities have. So when we think about partnerships, traditionally, the traditional research partnership for looking at a health problem in a community is, I as a researcher get a grant funded, because I had a great idea, because I know I'm a great person, I'm a researcher, I have a great idea, it's my idea, and now I'm going to find somebody who I'm going to convince it's a great idea and they're going to work with me. Another approach might be that someone in the community would have a great idea. And they would come and say, Keith, I have a great idea. I'd like for you to work with me on this idea. Because I've been talking with a couple groups in the community, and we really feel that one of the main problems in the community is the environment, that there's a lot of lead in the environment, and it's affecting the children, it's affecting their ability to do well in school. We think it's affecting the health. We can't convince anybody else that this is a problem. And would you partner with us to address this issue? And then in that partnership, I could potentially bring some academic resources, some academic perspectives. We could sit down and together design a project that would try to uncover what's going on, what the issue is. And in addition, through that process, there's an opportunity to increase the capacity of many members of that community to understand sort of more traditional approaches or more academic approaches to solving problems, health-related problems. And what does that bring? For a community-based organization, it brings certain skill sets that actually makes them more competitive for getting foundation grants. It also brings to the community a project that is their project, not my project. Because my project was about me. And I just thought that it was a good fit for the community. But it wasn't, it may not have been. But if it's a community's project, then it takes on a different life and there becomes a different ownership in that project. Equally as important is too frequently academia looks at a project that is looking at a health problem in a community in a way that may not be helpful for the community. So when you watch the news, are you going to see more good news or more bad news in the news?
Definitely bad.
Definitely bad. Why definitely bad?
What sells?
Because it sells. Because right? What is good news? What's good? So what happens to a researcher? They do research, and they get some results from a community. They are going to spin it that there's something really bad there. And part of the reason is because it sells. The other part is, it then says to a funding agency, wow, look at that problem you've uncovered. Maybe we'll pay you to try to fix it. So it enables them to better position themselves to get funded. But what does that do to the community? You've now attached a stigma to the community, and you've now, and you may maybe broken trust with individuals you've been working with on this project by presenting it that way. And there was an opportunity to present it differently. And particularly if the project is co-owned by the community and community members are involved in the interpretation of the data, the dissemination, how it gets talked about, how it gets written about, the channels. It could be described, the same results could be described in a way that says, wow, look at this community. This community for a variety of reasons, has some of the fewest resources in Area A of any community in the country. Despite that fact, they are still able to do A, B, and C. Look at the strength and the resiliency of that community. How can we, as researchers, in partnership with this community, help understand those factors that give that community that amount of strength and resiliency, and how can we maybe share that with other communities? And that can be the exact same project, but it's just a matter of how that information becomes disseminated. And in large part, if there is an actual partnership, a real partnership between community and academia, there's a better chance that that can happen. Now, what does partnership mean? So one example is I can have a grant that's, let's say it's $100,000 a year. And I call somebody up and I say, I want you to be my partner. I call up the local National Kidney Foundation or some organization. So I want you to be my partner. You're going to be my community partner. And what I want you to do is I want to give you a consulting agreement or agreement for $1,000. And I want you to help put together an advisory board. And we'd have this partnership. And that is one type of partnership to have. I have an advisory board, I have a community partner, and I have $99,000 out of the $100,000. That's not a bad partnership. There's another type of partnership where, and in that first partnership, we're doing my project. And that's how research has been done traditionally. That's how most research continues to be done in this country. Those are the results from that research, the mindset of the research faculty that influences health professionals and the way we have healthcare delivery all derives from that approach. But if we took an approach, one of the early approaches, where we actually get together, a community partner and myself, it could be my idea, it could be their idea, but we talk about it, we think about it, we meet with more community members, we talk about it, we put an application in, 50% of the dollars goes to community, 50% of the dollars goes to the university. Maybe it's 75-25. It could be, there may be specific reasons, but there should be substantial dollars going to both sides of the partnership. There should be equity in the roles and responsibilities of the community partners along with the academic partners. There should be equal voices amongst the two partners. Then you start to have a relationship that, in my mind, is better able to take advantage of the expertise of the community. So in our community, what we call our main community partners are PhDs of the sidewalk. So they have their PhDs as well, because they know about their community the depth of knowledge and understanding that researchers would know about the university. So we want to recognize that they have their degrees in understanding and knowledge about what they do. And we say that so a lot of faculty, when they're meeting and talking, that they, it's very easy for an academic person to think that they have, that there's this differential. Just that just because you have a degree and you have knowledge about something, that somehow that means you're better than somebody. But in fact, unfortunately, that is a too frequent mindset for many people who are research faculty. And don't hold that against the research faculty community. The process of going through school, being competitive, you're graded on a curve, you have to be better than the next person, you do better, everybody says you're really great, you go to the next level, now you're assistant professor, and you publish, and now you become associate professor. It really develops and it actually pre-selects people who are really good at thinking of themselves. Okay? That's what that whole process does. Doesn't mean everybody does that. But as a community, it pre-selects people who are good at that, and it reinforces that all the time. So it's hard to get the research community to, as a whole, just immediately embrace, yes, the rest of the world is equal with me. But there are people here who have been spending many years working on developing partnerships and collaborations because they have a different perspective of life and a different understanding and appreciation of the wealth and richness that having community partners can bring to both their research activities and to their personal life. So these partnerships are geared to get the health research community thinking more proactively about what are the relevant practical issues around health in local communities. Not what is my perception of what is important, but what is practical and relevant for that community. By putting the appropriate resources in there, we're now able to enhance the capacity of the community to be a stronger partner, both to partner with universities as well as to do other projects it may choose to do on its own. So that's an extremely important aspect of having what I think many people would consider true partnerships. Just looking out there, if I look so intense, really great. The issue of how we're going to transform health in this country, for me, is something that has more recently taken on an even higher level of interest, given the changes in the economy and the high cost of health, and to a large extent what I see as the healthcare system and the research behind it contributing to help bankrupt the entire economy. So at the end of the day, what we have to think about is what are cost-effective, relevant solutions to healthcare problems, and how do we as a team more effectively prevent medical problems from happening rather than how do we spend all the money to fix it after it's happened. So I was talking earlier, one example is heart disease. In the last 40 years, the average lifespan of an American has increased by about 4.5 years. So in the last 40 years, a person now lives 4.5 years longer than they did 40 years ago. 2.5 of those extra years is due to advances in cardiovascular disease. So different advances in heart disease, high blood pressure medicines, different heart surgeries and different procedures that we do. The question for the audience, for 50 cents, is of all those advances in heart disease and all the billions of dollars in and research we've spent in heart disease, what is the one advance that has contributed most to people living longer?
Aspirin.
One baby aspirin a day, 50 cents. So all those things, one baby aspirin a day. Now, so then we spent however many gazillion dollars, and half of the improvement in health is from one baby aspirin a day. However, less than half of the people who would benefit from taking one baby aspirin a day take it. So we could spend, in the next 40 years, we could spend another gazillion dollars on newer, fancier medications and newer, fancier heart bypass procedures, or we could figure out how to get the other people to take the medicine, the aspirin, once a day. And my sense is that wouldn't cost as much. I haven't done, you know, now as a researcher, maybe I could write a grant, we could study that and see. Because another problem we have in research is the perspective that a lot of studies in community, we said they're not scientific. It's hard to say how scientific it is if we do it. There's so many variables that impact it. And there's an impression in the research community that only something that's done in a very controlled, rigorous manner can actually give you an answer. And it gives you an answer. So that part is true. It gives you an answer. The question is, how relevant is that answer? So one thing that these partnerships between community and academic researchers, I believe, can create is the opportunity to start doing what's called practical research and practical trials. Right. So a lot of times a project is happening in the community and people get better and you say, well, but I don't really know why that person got better. They probably don't care. They just want to know that they got better. So that's important for a lot of people, that they got better. But the rigor for research and the study design that researchers talk about and it makes it difficult for many people who are interested in promoting community academic type research, what we call community focused research or community participatory research, is that there are other researchers that say, well, that's not really research, that's not going to give us that answer we want, and that you faculty that are doing that, you're not really faculty. You don't really know what it is you're doing. Just running around, going to some meetings and getting hors d'oeuvres and stuff. But at the end of the day, the question is, how are we going to really improve the health? And are those designs, are we looking for something that is going to be relevant? Or are we looking for something that's going to be really exciting, really great, and no one's going to use? So the National Institutes of Health, a few years ago, started promoting what it calls translational science, which is having teams work together across different disciplines and from basic research to community, so that people are thinking differently about what they're doing and really working on a project, not so they can get another paper published, but working on the project because they know at the end of the day, it's going to help improve somebody's life. And that's very difficult for a lot of people to understand, because their lives have been about getting papers published and not necessarily improving someone's life. And so if I'm in the lab and I say I'm really great and I'm smart and I'm working on this project, and I'm going to stop people from getting strokes. And I have this great project I'm working on. And I'm working on it for 10, 15 years, but I'm not going to tell anybody. It's a big secret. I'm going to let them know later. And at the end, it comes out, and it's ready. It's turned into a medication. The only problem is, if you take it, your hair turns green. So, everybody's hair turned green, that's okay, but look, you're not going to get a stroke. And many people say, well, I'm not going to take it. I'll take my chances with my blonde hair, black hair, gray hair, but I don't want green hair. So now, millions and millions of dollars have been invested in this drug for stroke research. But they never asked anybody, would they take it if it turned their hair green? Had they asked people in the beginning, and they told them, forget it, no one's going to use it, a lot of smart people who spent a lot of time and a lot of money could have put all that effort and energy into doing something else. And so having teams are important for bringing different thoughts together, different ideas together. And in my mind, every team, if you have chemists and you have physicists and you have engineers and you have medical researchers, whatever the teams are, you need to have members of the community on that team. Because they have a voice and an understanding and a perspective that many people who are in academia over a long period of time frequently forget. So, again, how do we move forward and get things that are practical? So one example, we have for most medications, we do what's called controlled trials. And you have a person, they take a placebo or the medicine, and then you can compare the two, and then at the end of the day, you can say, well, the person who took the medicine did better than the person who took the sugar pill or placebo. And that's how we know that really works. And if you don't do that, if you don't do that process, do that comparison, then you don't really know. A gentleman from London wrote a nice little article about parachutes. So if you jump out of a plane at 10,000 feet, there's people who live. But yet most people, if they had an option, would choose to put on the parachute. Would anybody here not put on a parachute if they had to jump out of a plane? Yet there is no controlled trial ever done that compared the outcomes of people with parachutes and without parachutes jumping out of a plane. There are none. So from a research perspective, one would say that we really don't know if parachutes are really better than not having a parachute. Because they say what you have is some observational data that suggests having a parachute might be a little better. But we don't really know. Yet those same individuals, and I put a dollar on this, would actually take the parachute if they had a chance. So the projects that many of us here are interested in pursuing when we look at how do we work with communities to come up with projects that are going to be relevant and practical, they may not have the same methodologic design that pure researchers say is really important, and that's the only way you can answer the question. They may not have that design. But I think many people feel comfortable that we can create projects with our community partners and academic partners that can give us very relevant, practical information that can bring extreme value to that community in many ways, and importantly, use that information to help other communities, and other communities can figure out, and hopefully other communities' information can flow back to our communities. So those are some of the challenges, and yet at the same time, what I think are some of the exciting potential of these partnerships. Now, I'll make a couple comments, and then we'll stop for some more food. Is anybody here actively involved in a community academic partnership or collaborative program? And do you have community advisory boards for your project? Now, community advisory boards are very important. It's also very important to remember having a community advisory board does not mean you have a partnership. It means you have a community advisory board. And advisory boards give advice. And people can take advice or not take advice. Now, community advisory boards, however, I think when one does have a partnership, the community advisory board can bring insights, and they can bring value, and they can bring expertise and partnerships and linkages that are extremely important. So what's important for a partnership, how many people here have memorandums of understanding? So you really want to have a memorandum of understanding. That's a document that says, we've agreed to work together, and here are the key principles that we agree to adhere to. And for individuals who are heading up or parts of community organizations, and you're approached from academia for a partnership, then you always want to make sure that that project, if it's a really partnership, that you have a memorandum of understanding. Now, everything does not, every activity does not have to be a partnership per se. There's a project where you can just be part of it. You don't necessarily have to be a full partner. But if you have, so it's like you have friends, right? So you have some friends, and they don't share everything with you. But if you have a significant other, your husband or wife, then you sort of have a partnership. You have a contract of some sort. You have a ring that signifies there's a partnership there. And that's a different relationship than you have with just a friend. Hopefully. But those types of partnerships that I think we want to promote more and more between community and academia are the really strong partnerships that are grounded in a memorandum of understanding that states, these are the key principles that we on each side agree to adhere to, that the partnership recognizes the strength and the wealth that the community partner brings to the academic partner, that the academic partner is committed to building capacity in its community partner, to respectfully recognizing their community partner, to supporting them in other activities. And I think through that collaboration, we can start developing new strategies for how we start approaching health in this country. And I think as those partnerships start to expand, we can hopefully start bringing other dimensions that community recognizes as important to health. So communities tend to recognize multiple dimensions that impact health. Many social determinants of health, the role of non-pharmacologic therapies, the role of adequate nutrition, the role of psychological well-being, the role of spirituality. All those aspects, through that partnership, will start diffusing into the research arm and should start causing a change in how researchers think about how they approach health and start helping researchers recognize the importance of the multiple dimensions of existence in life that impact on an individual and impact on an individual's health, impact on a community's health. So this is an opportunity for communities through this process to actually influence the research process and influence the research mindset. And once you do that, then the research that then starts influencing how medicine and health is practiced, that will start to change. And hopefully through that process, we'll actually have much more of a focus on prevention, on well-being, and hopefully on recognizing that there are many dimensions that influence health that we don't traditionally think about, and we can start thinking about how we can activate those elements to improve our health. So I think I'll sort of take a break here for more hors d'oeuvres, and then we'll do a sort of open Q&A discussion session thing. So thank you very much for your time and attention.